throughout the evening and into the overnight hours with lows around 55. Tomorrow, partly sunny and cooler with the high around 68. And there is a chance of rain again in the forecast Friday and Saturday with highs the rest of the week only in the mid to upper 50s and lows in the upper 30s to mid 40s. In other words, enjoy the warmer weather while it lasts. Taking a look at temperatures around the region at this hour in Chicago, overcast skies, 58 degrees. In Danville, it's clear and 70. Decatur, 72 degrees. In Joliet, it's 68. And in Peoria, we have a few clouds, 71 degrees. At Willard Airport in Champaign, a few clouds, 75 degrees. It's 76 outside our studios, or excuse me, 72 rather, here in Urbana. It's 12:39. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen in for Celeste Quinn. What started with a one-time screening of a sci-fi classic in Champaign has become an annual tradition featuring beloved but overlooked films as gauged by one of this area's native sons. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert previews the 14th annual Ebert Fest.
In 1997, film critic and University of Illinois graduate Roger Ebert introduced a screening of 2001 A Space Odyssey at Champaign's Virginia Theater as part of Cyberfest, a celebration of advances in computing on campus. It coincided with the birth of 2001's HAL 9000 computer, according to the Arthur C. Clarke novel on which the film was based. That event prompted the university to ask Ebert to start a film festival of his own. He initially declined, saying film critics can't be in the position of asking studios for favors.
And then I thought, well, what about an overlooked festival of films that deserve more attention than they've received?
Ebert appeared on WILL's Keeping the Faith in 1999, just before the first Ebert Fest.
Because every movie critic has a personal list of movies that he loves, that he has seen, and that he thinks didn't get a fair shake in the marketplace.
Ebert came up with such a list and showed them at the Virginia, and the Overlook Film Festival was born. It has since been dubbed Ebert Fest to celebrate its founder and to satisfy the concerns from some filmmakers who took offense at the notion that their work had been initially passed over. But festival director Nate Cohn says really nothing has changed in 13 years.
Putting a festival together is a lot like producing a motion picture. You know, just making something happen in the best way possible.
This year, Ebert offers a lineup featuring movies about obsessive sports fans, outcasts, and even one profiling a longtime filmmaker. The movies come from all over the world. For example, Patang, or The Kite, a drama from India, is made by a Chicago filmmaker.
Roger just happened to see the film, and it turns out that the father of the filmmaker was a student in Roger's class for a number of years at the University of Chicago. It was just a coincidence that his son made the film that Roger fell in love with.
Cohn says some guests of Ebert Fest find themselves coming back for the festival, like Australian director Paul Cox attending his fourth Ebert Fest, accompanying On Borrowed Time, a documentary about his own struggles with liver disease.
I wake up one morning and I don't feel well. And from there it was downhill. So then you wake up the middle of the night, if you sleep, and the first thought is, oh my God, I've got cancer, I'm going to die.
Among the newcomers to this year's Ebert Fest is comedian and actor Patton Oswalt, star of 2009's Big Fan, in which he plays an obsessive New York Giants fan addicted to sports talk radio.
Hey, Paul from Staten Island.
Hey.
What we got tonight?
Hey, what's up, dog? I gotta tell you, I am feeling good tonight because in a little less than 48 hours, we are gonna brutally shatter any flicker of hope the Cheesesteaks had going. We've been messing with them the last few weeks, letting them get back in it a little, making them think they had a chance of catching us, just so we can see the look on their faces when they come up short. Quantrell's back, baby.
Oswald's character, Paul, idolizes his favorite player on the field, but when he meets the player in real life, his idol not only fails to live up to Paul's expectations, the player beats him up. We watch as Paul's sports-dominated worldview is shaken. Oswald says he's not a sports fan, but didn't have to work hard to find Paul's edge.
I still understand that very, you know, personal wound-up energy that you're connecting to make yourself feel like you're taking up more of a space in the universe, whether it be, you know, your allegiance to a sports team or to a political ism or even a comic book or TV series. I mean, it's the same spark, it's just different fuel.
When asked by Ebert to attend this year's festival, Oswald had a request to introduce a film he loves, the 1949 Alec Guinness comedy Kind Hearts and Coronets. There's a free screening taking place Thursday night at the U of I's Fullinger Auditorium.
I think it's the template for how you make a dark comedy work, is all I'll say. There's too many surprises. I don't want to talk too much about it.
Besides entertaining audiences, there's an educational component to Ebert Fest. Attendees are encouraged to participate in panel discussions exploring a variety of aspects of filmmaking. U of I graduate Eric Pearson, another perennial guest, will lead one such discussion.
It's not the same kind of setting where people are at the Virginia Theater and you have very few people who get to ask questions kind of thing. It really is an opportunity for more of a conversational dialogue between people who are interested in film and people who are making film.
This montage here with the Bernard Herrmann jolly, cheerful music covers lots of time with a lot of short shots that lead now in this dramatic entrance to Wells at 25. This is the first time that anybody in the movie audience will have seen Wells as he looked at that time. Wells was famous for dramatic entrances. His entrance in the
Another highlight of this year's Ebert Fest is a screening of Orson Welles' classic, Citizen Kane. Featuring a commentary track Roger Ebert recorded for the 60th anniversary DVD back in 2001. That's 5 years before Ebert lost his ability to speak following treatment for cancer of the thyroid and salivary glands.
Oddly enough, I've taught Citizen Kane all over the country, but never at the university. This will allow my own speaking voice to be heard once again in the Virginia Theater.
That's Ebert speaking through Alex, a digital voice Apple offers on its Mac computers.
The Virginia is the heart and soul of the festival. It makes such a great impression on visitors. Some directors have told us this is the largest audience that has ever seen their film. My father told them he saw Harry Houdini and the Marx Brothers on that stage.
The 14th annual Ebert Fest kicks off tonight at 7 at the Virginia Theater with a screening of Joe vs. the Volcano. John Patrick Shanley's flawed but fascinating story of a man, a woman, a volcano, and watertight luggage. As Ebert said of the Tom Hanks' Meg Ryan vehicle in his 1990 review, he had not seen this movie before. The same could be said about many of the films at Ebert Fest this year. I'm Jeff Bossert, Illinois Public Media.
Our website includes three interviews with Roger Ebert. They include one from 1999 that Steve Shoemaker conducted on Keeping the Faith, one from 2003 from Bob McChesney on the program Media Matters, as well as Jeff's recent discussion with the Urbana native and film critic. There is also an interview there with Jeffrey Lerner, who produced Ebert's commentary for the Citizen Kane DVD. Of course, our website is will.illinois.edu. A schedule of films and panel discussions can be found at ebertfest.com. We are 93 days from the start of the London Olympics. A lot of attention, of course, will focus on some of the big athletic stars like the American swimmer Michael Phelps or Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt. This is also a good time to start talking about who among thousands of other athletes will emerge. Here's NPR's Tom Goldman.
Sure, it's unfair. 10,500 athletes of every shape, size, color, and skill due to compete in the London Olympics, and all the attention on two of them? Not that they didn't earn advanced billing.
Phelps above him in lane five. I don't know if he's going to catch him. He gets it done again.
He did it. He did it. He got it again.
And a fair start. Asafa Pound. Usain Bolt is also out well. Here they come down the track. Usain Bolt sprinting ahead, winning by daylight.
The exploits of American swimmer Michael Phelps and Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt, heard here on NBCOlympics.com, were showstoppers at the 2008 Beijing Games and whet our appetite for 2012. Phelps was unbeatable in China. He competed in 8 events and won them all, a record 8 gold medals. But in London, the plot will thicken.
Lochte in front. Lochte, will he get a world record? Oh, yes, he does. Lochte the gold and the world record. Phelps the silver.
U.S. teammate Ryan Lochte is not just a challenger, but the man to beat in events that also feature Phelps. Lochte beat Phelps twice in head-to-head meetings at last year's World Championships. Bolt comes into London as invincible as he was in 2008 when he set world records winning the 100 and 200 meters. He has won 22 of 24 100-meter races since then. You'll hear about a hot young Jamaican speedster named Johan Blake, also Asafa Powell, Americans Walter Dix, and Tyson Gay. But really, the clock remains Bolt's only true competition. His 100 world record stands at 9.58 seconds, but hopefully not for long, Bolt told the BBC this month.
If I can go 9-4, that'd be an honor for me because that's what people want to see. They want to be amazed. So I'm working as hard as possible. Hopefully I can go as fast as possible.
Working no less hard, and perhaps with a tad more humility, are the thousands of London-bound athletes whose stardom will be limited to the world of their chosen sport. Mikkel Hansen of the Danish men's handball team, or British cyclist Chris Hoy, or American rowing coxswain Mary Whipple, and don't call her 5'3" Mary Whipple.
5'3", and I always say a half because it means something.
5'3 and a half Whipple is a very big part of the defending Olympic champion women's eight team from the U.S. Whipple steers the boat and keeps her rowers, who average 6 feet and taller, synchronized. Just weeks after they won the gold medal in Beijing, the team started training for London. They only get Wednesday afternoons and Sundays off, all for another chance, says Whipple, to experience perfection as they did in China.
If you've ever connected with a golf ball and you just had like this one epic drive, if you can synchronize all eight oars and you're doing exactly what you need to be doing at that moment, it's the best feeling in the world.
10,500 athletes, some you've heard of, most you haven't, heading for London and aiming for that same elusive goal, to do what they need to do at just the right Olympic moment. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Standing 5'8" and weighing over 300 pounds, Cheryl Hayward struggles to defend her champion weightlifting status. Strong, our next community cinema, chronicles her journey and the challenges this unusual elite athlete faces, exploring popular notions of power, strength, beauty, and health. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, May 1st, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 25th of April, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Ted Kooser, born Ames, Iowa, 1939, who said, "I had a wonderfully happy childhood." He started writing poetry seriously as a teenager. He said, "I was desperately interested in being interesting. Poetry seemed a way of being different." Went to college, flunked out of grad school, took the first job he was offered at a life insurance company, worked there for 35 years. Ted Kooser says, "I believe that writers write for perceived communities. I worked every day with people who didn't read poetry, who hadn't read it since they were in high school, and I wanted to write for them." So, every morning he got up at 4:30, made a pot of coffee, wrote until 7, then he put on his suit and his tie, and he went to work. It's the birthday of Howard R. Garris, born in Binghamton, New York, 1873, who gave us Uncle Wiggily, the old rabbit in the suit and the top hat. Garris was a reporter for the Newark Evening News. He wrote hundreds of children's books, published his first Uncle Wiggily story in a newspaper in 1910. It was so popular, he ended up writing an Uncle Wiggily story 6 days a week for more than 30 years. Howard R. Garris said, "Half the fun of nearly everything is thinking about it beforehand or afterward." It's the birthday of Ella Fitzgerald, Newport News, Virginia, 1917. When she was 16, she entered a contest at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, walked on stage wearing ragged clothes, men's boots. She sang, "The Object of My Affection," won the contest. Soon she was fully employed in the nightclubs of New York. Ella Fitzgerald, who said, "The only thing better than singing is more singing." And it's the birthday of Paget Powell, born Gainesville, Florida, 1952. went to college, studied chemistry, spent 8 years as a roofer in Texas working on a novel on the side. His latest book comes out this summer, You and Me. Here's a poem by Ted Kooser on his birthday, a poem entitled How to Foretell a Change in the Weather. Rain always follows the cattle sniffing the air and huddling in fields with their heads to the lee. You will know that the weather is changing when your sheep leave the pasture too slowly and your dogs lie about and look tired, when the cat turns her back to the fire, washing her face, and the pigs wallow in litter. Cocks will be crowing at unusual hours, flapping their wings. Hens will chant. When your ducks and your geese are too noisy, and the pigeons are washing themselves, when the peacocks squall loudly from the tops of the trees, when the guinea fowl grates, when sparrows chip loudly and fuss in the roadway, and when swallows fly low